You're listening to The Sound Off. The Sound Off. With the Solomonster. Solomonster.
Cena is starting to bore me.
What?
It's the same stuff each and every week.
This is WrestleMania, Mean Gene. I'm on a roll this week. I got a hole-in-one playing golf. I've been hot at the tables. Oh. Mr. Perfect is exactly what he says he is. Perfect.
I'm not going to lie. I am still suffering the effects of a massive hangover. And so, just FYI, if I sound a little low-key this week, you'll know why. This is episode 146 of The Sound Off here on SCScoops.com. It is late here on Sunday, February 13th. 2011. Happy early Valentine's Day to all of the female followers of the podcast, of which I know there are many. Got a couple of things I want to talk about here this week, but I want to lead off with a few thoughts on an important event. It is, for the benefit of those of you who do not know, the 8-year anniversary of the death of Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, who was found dead in a hotel room back in February of 2003, what would have been this past week, found dead of an acute cocaine intoxication was the official result from the medical examiner. And, of course, his father had spoken about the fact that Kurt was heavy into painkillers and steroids and things of that nature. So another wrestler gone in his mid-40s, but not just another wrestler. Mr. Perfect, you know, for me growing up as a fan of the WWF, and for others, perhaps, who grew up a fan of the AWA, where Kurt won their championship in the late 80s, anybody familiar with Kurt's work inside the ring was ultimately very impressed by him. And if you weren't, then I don't know what you were watching. But he was one hell of a performer, certainly more so earlier in his career than in the later part, which is not to say that his later years in the WWF or in WCW were bad. But Mr. Perfect, at his best, was easily the best bumper in the industry at the time. And Rick Rude had a reputation for being a great bumper as well, another native, I believe, from Minnesota. But Kurt was just, you know, as a heel, such a great bumper in the ring, taking these big, you know, even the most mundane of bumps. And if you were to watch a Kurt Hennig match now and see this, it would seem way over the top. But he was just so good in the ring, and you know, a great technical performer as well, and moved around very well in the ring. And to me, he will go down perhaps as the greatest, or at least my favorite, Intercontinental Champion, 2-time Intercontinental Champion, just because there was something about him that made it seem like that title was almost tailor-made for him. You know, when the Intercontinental belt was wrapped around his waist, it just felt like it was in its right place. It was in its rightful place. And he's had some great matches with people over the years. Of course, chief among them probably were his matches with Bret the Hitman Hart. Bret Hart has said that Kurt was one of his all-time favorite opponents and that perhaps the best match they ever had together wasn't even filmed for television. It was probably a house show match back in 1989, if I remember. I think Bret talked about this on his DVD, and on Bret Hart's DVD, that is. Obviously, his SummerSlam 91 match at Madison Square Garden with Bret Hart, and a match, mind you, that Kurt wrestled probably under heavy sedation because his back was completely shot at that particular time, and that was just a fantastic match. Perhaps the match they had in the semifinals of the 1993 King of the Ring I enjoyed better than the Summers. The SummerSlam match had more emotion. And it was for a championship. But that King of the Ring match in 93, when the two of them were both babyfaces, I very much enjoyed that match. The matches Kurt had with Ric Flair and other performers in his heyday. In fact, one of my all-time favorite matches was a Saturday Night's Main Event match in 1990, which saw Mr. Perfect defend the Intercontinental title against Tito Santana. And I think it was July of 1990. If you could find footage of that match, which may well have been on the WWE Saturday Night's Main Event DVD they put out a couple of years ago, seek that out, because that was one hell of a match between the two of them. And I just think of a whole bunch of random Mr. Perfect matches and moments are popping into my head right now. So I just wanted to mention that. It's been 8 years since he died. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2007. I know his wife posthumously signed a Legends contract after his death. And, you know, he's been in the video games and all these other different things. He certainly has not been forgotten. And I just wanted to make mention of that here because he was one of the all-time greats in the wrestling business, and it's really a shame that we don't have the chance to see him do more with the WWE now. Got some Raw thoughts from this past week. Not a great show, in my opinion. To me, the biggest reason for that was the horrible crowd in Milwaukee. You would think that, granted, it wasn't Green Bay, as R-Truth found out. But still, you would think the crowd would be more up. They would be more into it. To me, the crowd sucked the cock last Monday. They just did not seem to be into anything on that show. And it really did hurt the show. It just goes to show you how powerful a hot crowd can be to make a good show great or an okay show very good, which this one was not. A lot of people emailed me about CM Punk coming out and mentioning that you know, Orton had wronged him over 2 years ago. Of course, when CM Punk was the babyface world heavyweight champion for the first time, he never actually lost the title. The title was essentially stripped from him because of his inability to compete in the scramble match at what I believe was the Unforgiven pay-per-view. That would have been in September of 08. And it was because Randy Orton and Legacy attacked him backstage. And I think I had mentioned that, and people pointed this out in emails to me that I did mention this. Back around Slammy time, when CM Punk won a Slammy and mentioned that somebody in the back had wronged him and he would soon seek revenge on that person. Of course, he then feuded briefly with John Cena, but I had mentioned that perhaps Randy Orton would be the culprit because of that angle, and I didn't think WWE would ever you know, make mention of something that happened all those years ago. And I was very surprised to see that that is in fact what they did. I was actually impressed by that. So you've got this back issue. Now, granted, you know, you could say, well, it's been a couple of years. It seems kind of far-fetched. But you know what? Not really. Because if I'm CM Punk, for the longest time, I believe he and Orton were on different brands. And so they were kind of kept apart. Not for the entire time, but for much of that time. And the fact is, again, CM Punk, that was his first reign as World Heavyweight Champion, excluding his ECW title reign. And he had that taken away from him. He was never actually beaten for the title, and he can thank Randy Orton for that. And so it would stand to reason. There's now a reason for the two of them to have personal animosity between one another. And I think that's great. I think that's a great thing. We had Vince McMahon come out at the beginning of the show to announce that this upcoming Monday night, probably by the time you listen to this, in fact, on Raw, he would announce the official guest host for WrestleMania 27 in Atlanta. And then just as soon as he made that announcement, he disappeared, and he was never seen or heard from again for the remainder of the show. This was Vince's first official appearance back on Raw, aside from that stupid skit a couple of months ago, since the Nexus beatdown of him last summer. And Vince McMahon, I think at this point, and 65 years of age or so, is probably best in small doses like this. But apparently Vince will be back this week to announce the guest host, which, of course, kicked off a lot of great speculation. Who would this person be? My first thought, just for whatever it's worth, the first name that popped in my head was The Rock. You know, The Rock had that long Facebook post within the last 2 weeks where he basically, again, reiterated that he will not wrestle ever again. He quietly retired in 2004, but he was definitely going to be back in the fold on TV at some point with WWE to do something major. And, of course, there was a lot of talk that The Rock would host Raw at some point, and they've kind of killed off the guest host concept for Raw. And if I had to think of a WWE guy big enough to host an event like WrestleMania, I think The Rock would probably be that person. Now, The Rock is still my pick. You can, you know, some people have said Stone Cold Steve Austin. That would make sense as well. Austin certainly is another big name from the past. For whatever reason, to me, not that I dislike Austin, quite the contrary, but I think if they announced Austin, which would totally make sense, given that he is the new host of Tough Enough, and Tough Enough actually premieres on USA the night after WrestleMania, so there's your cross-promotion right there. But to me, at this point, Austin just would seem almost underwhelming to me compared to The Rock, and I'm sure that's entirely due to the fact that we've seen Austin far more times in the last 6 or 7 years than we have The Rock. I'm pulling for The Rock, but here's a dark horse mention here. Bob Barker could very well be that person as well. Let's not forget about him. He's been announced for WrestleMania. He will be a celebrity guest. And I know WWE was very, very happy with his performance last year when he guest-hosted Raw. So was I. I thought Bob, for a guy his age, and he's very old, if he's in his 70s, he might even be in his 80s at this point, he was just on his A-game on that show. He seemed like he had the time of his life. He didn't stammer. He didn't stutter. He knew his role. He was very entertaining. I look forward to seeing him at WrestleMania, but I feel like the way that that announcement was built up, if it turns out to be Bob Barker and not somebody like The Rock or Steve Austin, I think it'll be a disappointment in many people's eyes. So, but we'll see. I mean, think about it. Bob Barker was a host for his entire life of many different game shows, not just The Price is Right. It's what he did for a living for 50 years on television. He hosted. And we know he's going to be at WrestleMania. And if he doesn't host WrestleMania, then what the hell are they going to do with him? Aside from use him in some, you know, comedy skit backstage. So, yeah, I'm going with The Rock or Bob Barker on this one. But any of those three, I think, would make some degree of sense. We saw the 2:21:11 video, a different one this time. And this time they made it a little more obvious who it was for. They played a brief clip from the Johnny Cash song Ain't No Grave, which they used as part of the promotion for the Undertaker Shawn Michaels match at last year's WrestleMania. And if you think about the lyrics, of course, the last time we saw The Undertaker on TV, he was in fact being buried inside of a shallow grave. So I think it's quite obvious this video is in fact for The Undertaker. Now, that does not mean that, again, for all the Sting fans out there who are still holding out hope that Sting will appear on Raw on the 21st, keep hope alive is what I say, because just because this video is not for him does not mean that he cannot appear on that show in some capacity. A lot of people like the idea that I threw out there last week of Undertaker coming out and at the end of the show, you know, the lights flicker, there's some lightning, and kind of look up at the WrestleMania 27 sign, and standing on top of the WrestleMania sign is Sting, wearing his leather coat with a black baseball bat, pointing down at the Undertaker, and then you kind of fade to black. I think it would be, it would send goosebumps up my arms. I think it just, I just visualize that, and it's such a great angle. But as far as I know, there's been no conversations still between the two sides. Sting was quietly removed from the TNA roster page. It's interesting to note that Kevin Nash was on the TNA roster page all this time, up until I think a few days before the Royal Rumble, when they basically knew he was leaving. I wouldn't read too much into that. It's an interesting little sign, but I wouldn't read too much into that right now. So, yeah, it was it's an Undertaker video for sure. But again, like I said, that does not mean they still can't have somebody else show up on that show. Now, before I get to the rest of Raw, while I'm talking about the Undertaker, may as well talk about the other big story of the week. Undertaker and Wade Barrett for the last several weeks was Vince McMahon's plan as one of the WrestleMania main events. And I had said before that while I like Wade Barrett as a performer, and I think he did a fantastic job, at least on the mic, leading the Nexus all those months, the idea of an Undertaker-Wade Barrett match at WrestleMania did nothing for me. And it does nothing for Wade Barrett, because there's no way he's being put over The Undertaker. I wasn't enthused about the idea of Undertaker and Kane, which was talked about, or Undertaker and Ezekiel Jackson, which, thank God, was only briefly talked about. But then came Undertaker and Sting, which people, you know, drew all these conclusions from the video. It must be for Sting, and of course we know now it is not for Sting. So if it's not going to be Undertaker and Barrett at WrestleMania, and it's likely not going to be Undertaker and Sting, and Undertaker has told Vince McMahon and WWE, I will be ready for WrestleMania. And they're taking him at his word that his shoulder will be at least mostly recovered enough for him to do a singles match at the pay-per-view. So what do you do with him? Well, it appears that, based on all the different stories coming out that seem to be pretty consistent, it may well be Undertaker and Triple H at WrestleMania, which, of course, would suck for Sheamus and may perhaps shed some light on why Sheamus has not been protected at all for a while now. I mean, Sheamus, you know, even on Raw Monday night, Sheamus was just treated like jobber dirt on that show. And it's a shame, because he's better than that. You know, they had built a real main eventer in Sheamus, and it took them even less time to just tear the fucking guy down. So if it's not going to be Sheamus and Triple H heading into WrestleMania, and Triple H is going to be back for WrestleMania, we all know this, they have now shifted their focus to what they feel is a WrestleMania-worthy battle. Now, if they did this, it would be 10 years since the last Undertaker-Triple H match at WrestleMania, which I actually thought was a pretty damn good match. There were no titles on the line, nor would there be here. It was simply a one-on-one match. It was at the Astrodome in Houston, which was Undertaker's backyard. He was still Biker Taker at the time, coming out to Limp Bizkit, and they had a damn good match that Undertaker won clean to go 9-0. So here we are a decade later, and we may well be in line for another battle between these two guys. Now, there's a million different ways you can go with this if they wanted to do Undertaker and Triple H, which is better than Undertaker Wade Barrett. I will give them that. But I just can't get out of my mind the image of Undertaker and Triple H at the 2002 King of the Ring, which was one of the most god-awful championship matches I think I've probably ever seen. Not the worst. There's been worse. Kurt Angle and Mark Henry, Big Show and Big Boss Man at Armageddon, also I think about 10 or 11 years ago. But they had a terrible match. I mean, and Undertaker, again, is in even worse shape physically. Triple H is coming back off an injury, and I don't have any doubts the two of them would go balls to the wall and try to put on the best match they possibly could. You add into that the idea that perhaps Shawn Michaels may factor into this. Obviously, Triple H and Shawn Michaels, members of DX, best buds. Triple H probably will be inducting Shawn into the Hall of Fame, which again can tie into this whole storyline of Triple H trying to avenge his friend, who was basically beaten and embarrassed and retired by The Undertaker, beaten 2 years in a row at WrestleMania. And, you know, Triple H is looking to come back and gain a measure of revenge for his friend, to try to prove that The Undertaker is, in fact, not invincible. He is very much beatable. And who better to try to end his streak than the game? So, I mean, there's your storyline right there. And you can have Shawn Michaels on the show even refereeing the match, which would be kind of amusing, because I remember there being talked of Shawn Michaels back at WrestleMania 17, when Undertaker and Triple H had their first match, that Shawn was supposed to referee that match as well. And as the story goes, Shawn was supposed to make some appearances on Raw. He showed up to the building one night in no condition to perform. And even Undertaker and Triple H loudly complained and had him excommunicated from the locker room, which probably is what led to the bad blood between Shawn and Triple H. They were not on speaking terms for a while, although that may have been before that. I know there was a period of time that went by around 2000, 2001, where the two of them were not on speaking terms. But as it turned out, because of that, Shawn did not perform at WrestleMania. I don't think you'll have the same problem or the same concerns with Shawn Michaels now that you did a decade ago. And he can. It's a way to get him on the show. He'll be there, obviously, since he's going into the Hall of Fame. It's a way to get him on the show without him having to wrestle. And you have the question of, can Shawn Michaels be an impartial referee in a match that involves his best friend going up against the man that basically put him out to pasture? And there's your WrestleMania main event, if that's the direction they want to go in. I like the intrigue of an Undertaker-Sting match more, just because you have these two dark characters that have never had a match before. It's one of those last kind of unique wrestling dream scenarios. But you know what? Undertaker Triple H, to me, I'd be okay with that. If that's their goal right now, and it looks like that's the plan, I'm okay with that. And you put Shawn Michaels in the middle of it, and you can really build some intrigue, I think, going into this match. And hell, it keeps Triple H out of the world title picture, so I really don't have a problem with that, and it looks like that's the direction they're going in right now. Anyway, on SmackDown this week, we had an appearance by several members of the Green Bay Packers. Sans, the actual quarterback, Aaron Rodgers, was not there, which is kind of funny, given that he was the one who was in the press all week with pictures of a championship belt on his shoulder, and he was the one who did not appear on SmackDown. But it was kind of cool for what it was. I saw some clips of it. There was some controversy at the end of the show. You know, Edge defeated Dolph Ziggler. Vicky Guerrero was the special referee, and she kept trying to fast count Edge. And a lot of stuff happened at the end. It was kind of a cluster, but you know, it was a fine finish to the show. And now it looks like there's some degree of controversy as it relates to the World Heavyweight Championship, and that Dolph Ziggler had posted a comment, a kayfabe comment, on his Twitter about a day or two ago about how it's good to be the new World Heavyweight Champion. And it wouldn't shock me if he either was essentially handed the belt because of that, which, of course, it would actually make sense for them to do this. I mean, Dolph has been treated like dog shit. I mean, he just keeps losing and losing and consistently is made to look like a jobber every week. So if the poor bastard is going to win the world title, I cannot think of a shittier way and yet a more appropriate way for him to kind of backdoor his way into his first world heavyweight title than to do it this way. It's either going to be that, perhaps the title will be held up vacant in the Elimination Chamber so that Edge can get it back and become an 11-time world champion. I guess we'll find out this week, but it looks like that title is on the move. It's just a matter of who it's moving to. Miami won the bidding for WrestleMania 28. That was the other big announcement this week. In 2012, for the first time, WrestleMania will come to Miami at, I guess, Sun Life Stadium is going to be the location. It's an outdoor stadium, no roof. So, again, you're kind of taking your life into your own hands in Florida in March or April, I guess, with the way the weather and the rains can be. It actually did rain a little bit at the beginning of WrestleMania 24 in Orlando a couple of years ago, but the rain quickly passed, I believe. So hopefully they'll have nice weather. I like the outdoor shows. I know Jim Ross raised this concern on his blog, and it is a concern that when you have an open-air stadium like that, sound travels up, and so crowd pops and crowd reactions may not sound as nice or as loud as it would in an indoor arena. But it was a beautiful setup they had at what, by and large, people said was a complete dump. That was the Citrus Bowl in Orlando. And WWE did a pretty good job of giving it a little bit of a facelift and making it look nice for WrestleMania. So I was actually stunned when I heard this, because it seemed like it was almost a lock that WrestleMania was coming back to Toronto next year. What used to be called the Sky Dome, which, of course, was the site of WrestleMania 6 and WrestleMania 18, infamous Rock vs. Hogan match, and Hogan vs. Warrior, respectively, that they would be coming back for a third time to the what is now called the Rogers Center. And even Edge, I think, at a house show about a week or so ago, got on the mic after his match and made a comment to the effect of, "I hope that I can end my career where it started, in Toronto." And I think what he meant by that was, Edge was in the crowd at WrestleMania 6. He was a big Hulk Hogan fan growing up, and he was in the crowd, and he's talked about this before. He was like 10 rows in or something, 6 rows in, and was devastated when Hogan lost to the Warrior. So for him to be able, if his career is winding down, you know, Shawn Michaels told people a year, easily a year before he retired, that WrestleMania 26 in Phoenix was the date that he pegged to call it quits, and he did. And I guess Edge, it was almost like Edge was doing the same thing by saying, you know, if WrestleMania is in Toronto next year, that would be a good place for me to kind of end my career. And then WWE kind of took a different turn, and they're going back to Florida for the second time in 3 years. And, you know, when you consider the fact, I mean, it's actually, to me, it's very surprising. And it makes me wonder how much UFC might have factored into this. So for those of you who haven't been following the news about UFC, is having their first show at a big, big arena, I guess, stadium in the Rogers Center. They're coming basically to the Sky Dome for their first event. It's their big pay-per-view coming up on April 30th, of course. George St. Pierre, one of the most popular fighters in the world, facing off with Jake Shields. And it's going to be a big show. So big, in fact, that UFC was only planning, I think, on putting about 30 or 40,000 tickets on sale, which would easily be their biggest gate and their biggest audience for a show ever. I think their previous record was about 21,000. And they put their tickets on sale, and I think what was the pre-sale, and they just completely sold out. I think 33,000 tickets went like that. and they put more tickets on sale, and basically they've cut off ticket sales at around 55,000. And it's just a very, very impressive showing by UFC. To the point where if they would have put more tickets on sale, 60 or 70,000, they'd probably be completely rid of those as well. They've already doubled their biggest gate ever, which I think was for a Brock Lesnar fight, right around $5 million. So they've already grossed $10 million and sold 55,000 tickets to an event coming up in a couple of months. Their first foray into the big Rogers Center in Toronto. And it just makes me wonder if WWE took this into consideration, if Toronto was their pick, and perhaps within the last couple of weeks, recognizing the interest in that UFC show, although I don't think they could have foreseen them selling 55,000 tickets like that. And by that point, they already had made up their mind about Miami. But I think UFC probably had more to do with this than they're being given credit for. And WWE recognized that, business compared to what it used to be for them right now is pretty damn soft, even for WrestleMania. It's not as easy to sell WrestleMania to people as it once was. And I don't think they wanted to run the risk of putting tickets on sale, making a big announcement, and being overshadowed by UFC. I just really think that that factored into their thinking. And it's all kind of funny in a way, because it just goes to show you that for all the talk publicly by Vince McMahon and others in the company that they don't consider UFC to be competition, even though UFC is competing, in fact, for their tickets and for their dollars, I don't really understand the justification for that. And obviously, behind the scenes, they're not stupid. I mean, they know UFC is very much a competitor to their business, but this would be a shining example of that. And it looks like WrestleMania, going back to Florida. There's some talk of perhaps Indianapolis the year after, and then probably coming back to the Big Apple for WrestleMania 30, which I got my fingers crossed for that. I know that I've already been asked by my good buddy Noah Mark about coming to WrestleMania next year in Miami. I'm considering it. I've never been to a WrestleMania before. I've seen every single WrestleMania more than once. I've been to a couple of pay-per-views. I went to my first Royal Rumble a couple of years ago. It's a lot of fun. And again, if anybody has an opportunity to attend a live pay-per-view show, even if it's Fatal 4-Way, which is what I went to last year, which was actually not a great show, but it was more fun for me being there than it would have. Well, I would never have even bought it on pay-per-view if I wasn't there. But definitely take advantage of that, because you'll have a fucking blast. And I can only imagine what it must be like to have even decent seats at a WrestleMania show. And I always figured I'll wait until WrestleMania comes back to New York City and hopefully grab some tickets then. But I am intrigued by the idea of WrestleMania coming to Miami Beach. And I will consider it. I will consider attending WrestleMania next year, but we'll see what happens. All right, mailbag time. I am very backlogged here and have a lot of letters to get to. I want to get to as many as I can. Chris Johnson will take his first. Your Sala Monster. Chris, by the way, is in the UK, as many, many, many of our listeners are. Question comes in two parts. Part one here. Who do you think has the best power bomb of all time? Well, this, of course, it's very subjective, and I'm sure there's a lot of, for example, Japanese wrestlers that utilize the power bomb, and I don't know all of them. So having said that, I am actually of the thought that Vader and Sid were two of the better powerbomb users. First of all, anytime Vader did anything, if Vader just touched you with his pinky finger, it was stiff. Vader really beat the shit out of people. And, a lot of his moves, his punches especially, looked very brutal. I mean, just talk to Mick Foley about that. But the power bomb, when Vader used it, when he was Big Van Vader, for example, in WCW, not so much when he was in WWF, was a very brutal move. And in fact, he damn near, well, I know the story is he actually did break a jobber's back. I don't know if he actually broke his back, but he certainly did damage to the back of a jobber in WCW in the early 90s with a power bomb. And whenever he executed the move, it looked devastating, even on referees. His first night in, actually it was technically his second night in, but it was Vader's first live appearance on Raw the night after the Royal Rumble in 1996. And Vader, I think it might have been a match with Savio Vega, but Vader, I think, beat his opponent, went nuts, and referee Jack Doan was the unfortunate recipient of a Vader powerbomb that also looked pretty brutal at the time. And then, of course, out came Gorilla Monsoon, who was the president of the WWF at the time. And he got beaten up and Vader bombed by Vader. So anyway, Vader would probably be my pick, but I was always a big fan of the way that Sid, Psycho Sid, Sid Vicious, Sid Justice, call him whatever you want. I thought he always did the powerbomb very well. You know, the powerbomb became synonymous with Sid. Sid got that move over. You know, when he came back to WWF in 1996, he was over like gangbusters. And a lot of that was also because of that move. People popped huge for the powerbomb when Sid would do it. And Sid would actually protect you more than somebody like Kevin Nash would. I mean, Kevin Nash would pick somebody up for a powerbomb and just dump them down with virtually no regard for how they landed, no regard for their body whatsoever. Sid, and sometimes, you know, Sid would do it and it wouldn't look as impactful because he would try to protect the guy on the way down. But I was always a big fan of Sid calling for the powerbomb and using the powerbomb. And like I said previously on one of these shows, we don't see the powerbomb used that way anymore, and I think we should. I think it's one of those moves that's not all that difficult to pull off. If you're a bigger guy, it's very impressive looking. And, you know, it's one of those moves I think that could get over very easily. So, yeah, Vader or Sid would be my pick for that. Second part of Chris's question here. If I could pick a Survivor Series team of five, dead or alive, but they all have to have the same first name, who would you choose? Well, this is only the first letter I'm reading here this week, but already the award for most innovative, creative question of the week goes to Chris. I have never gotten a question phrase quite like that before, but I'll tell you what. Steve Austin, Steve Regal, Steve Blackman, Steve Mongo McMichael, and Dr. Death Steve Williams. How's that for you for a motley crew of wrestlers named Steve? Jared writes in. He has been listening to the podcast since the very beginning, practically, somewhere between episodes number 1 and number 10, so I appreciate that. His question is, what was your favorite Survivor Series pay-per-view and your favorite match on the card? Mine was 1998, the entire tournament I loved. The Deadly Game tournament in 1998, I look back on that more fondly than I did at the time. I think at the time, again, I was still a big fan of Survivor Series elimination matches, so when they announced the tournament full of singles matches, I was kind of deflated about that. But I look back on that now. It was a very unique thing for them to do, to hold up the championship and put it on the line in a one-night elimination tournament, which I know WWE does not like doing tournaments, and they don't think they sell, which is a big part of why King of the Ring is no longer a pay-per-view. And it's not something I think that would even be the same if they tried it now, because you've got so many world championships. You know, at one point you had three when the ECW title was still around. Now you have two different world titles. So what are you going to do? You're going to give precedence to one belt and create an entire pay-per-view just for that one tournament, for that one championship? It was something that worked back then. It wouldn't work now, I don't think. Not unless they unified the belts. But I look back on that, and you know what? It wasn't a bad show. There were some real crappy matches on that show, but I liked the concept of the Deadly Game tournament. That being said, I'm gonna probably go with 1995. In all honesty, not to say that from top to bottom it was such a fantastic card, but I loved the idea at the time of the wild card match. It was the one and only time they ever did it. And it was an idea conceived by the president, Gorilla Monsoon. And essentially what it was a mix of two teams that each was comprised of babyfaces and heels. So it wasn't babyfaces against heels. It was kind of it was randomized. And so on one team you had Shawn Michaels and Ahmed Johnson, who I think also had the British Bulldog on their team. And I may have my team members wrong. I know the Bulldog was in there, Owen was in there, Dean Douglas was in there, Razor Ramon, Yokozuna, they were on the same team. It was just unique. It was something we had never seen before, and it was a pretty good match on top of that. And Shawn Michaels, this was his first pay-per-view back in action since he had been beaten up by 10 thugs in Syracuse, New York, and had to forfeit the Intercontinental title. The main event was probably one of the best Kevin Nash matches ever. Bret Hart carried Diesel to a pretty damn good main event. Bret won the championship. And speaking of power bombs, that was when Diesel flipped his lid and turned heel after the match and gave Bret Hart two jackknife power bombs and left to a very mixed reaction from the crowd in Maryland. So I'm going to go with the 95 Survivor Series in the wild card match. I really liked that at the time. And even watching it recently on WWE Classics On Demand, it holds up. It's pretty good stuff. Got an email here from one of the posters on sescoops.com. I just wanted to read this here. It's not a question, really. It says, Solomon, sir, I hope you read this. I'd like to apologize to you. In my mind, I've been slagging you off ever since I saw your name on the SC Scoops site without ever bothering to listen to one of your podcasts. And when I saw that you'd be giving your opinion on the 2-21-11 thing, I thought I would listen and wanted to let you know that I'm sorry. Everything you've said, I've agreed with. You speak the truth, and you're 100% right, so I'm sorry. And I'm going to be a regular listener of yours from now on. That comes from NUFCman13 on scscoops.com. So I wouldn't say I'm 100% right about anything all the time, but I appreciate the kind words. By the way, I have to thank the 38 people who emailed me and posted on Facebook and sent me Twitter messages about the same thing last week. It's my fault because I should have mentioned it on the last Sound Off. I did see that CZW video that went viral with the Osirian portal hypnotizing their opponents, and it became a big internet sensation. I actually saw it prior to last week's podcast and should have mentioned it, and I didn't. And so everybody and their mother emailed me with links to the video asking me if I've seen this. So I have seen the video, and I thought it was cute. It's one of those things, not CZW, but Chikara. If you're not familiar with Chikara, do a YouTube search for it. They do similar kind of funny things and have gimmicks like that. And you know, things like that have a place in wrestling. I don't really have a problem with it. Unfortunately, when they do comedy, it's usually pretty funny. And when WWE does, it's not. So if WWE can make their could limit their comedy but make it really funny, I would love it. And as stupid and over-the-top as this stuff really is, I thought it was awesome. I thought it was a great video. It's a great gimmick that they have. It's not main event level stuff at all. And in fact, stuff like this will keep those guys far, far, far away from the main events. But I really enjoyed it. I especially love in Chikara, I think it is, the ant people who, and I've seen one or two matches like this where the match almost stops and things go in slow motion and one guy is kind of ripping the clip out of what would be a grenade in his hand. He throws a grenade and somebody dives on top of the grenade, and it's just really funny stuff that they do. Nee from the Philippines writes in. He was wondering what happened the following Raw when Shawn Michaels won the Elimination Chamber at the 2002 Survivor Series at MSG for the World Heavyweight Championship. Well, he came out and cut a promo on Raw the next night. That's what happened. I do remember Shawn having a match with Rob Van Dam. I don't know if it was the night after, and I think he actually had a match with Bill Goldberg on Raw as well, but the match with Shawn and RVD, which I, if I'm remembering correctly, was for Shawn's world title. If it wasn't the next night, it was shortly, maybe it was the week after, because Shawn only had the belt for about 3 or 4 weeks before he dropped it back to Triple H at Armageddon the following month. But I remember him having a title defense with RVD around that time. Beyond that, Shawn didn't really do much because he didn't hold the title for that long. Let's see here. Another person writes in, just thought of something, was watching SmackDown, and was very impressed with Dolph Ziggler, was trying to think of a better name he could use. Do you have any ideas? Any name. Any name is better than Dolph Ziggler. I mean, we've talked about this before. It's really, I mean, it's poor booking right now is what's holding him back, but that name, that fucking name, the name Xavier, I think, would be better than Dolph. And that's no offense to Dolph Lundgren, who is a rather good actor, but Dolph Ziggler? Yeah, I think any name, if you close your eyes and completely cleared your mind, and maybe, you know, threw back a few cold ones, the first name that popped into your head, I'm willing to bet, is probably going to be better than Dolph Ziggler. So why don't you try doing that and then write me back with the name that popped into your head, and I'll mention it next week. In fact, I'll throw that challenge out to everybody listening to the podcast right now. Get a little hammered, clear your mind, come up with the first name that pops into your head, Let me know what it is, and I'll read off some new names for Dolph Ziggler next week, and we'll pick a new name for him. Alvin writes into the podcast here, do you think that if it wasn't for fire regulations and the entrance setup being so big and better creative writers that WrestleMania would ever sell out and break their record of 93,000 people from WrestleMania 3? Also, he throws the idea out there, Alvin does, of perhaps Ted Turner being the guest host of WrestleMania. Well, that's not going to happen. But an interesting note on the 93,000, because there's still people out there who believe that number, as I did for many years. And then I started hearing that the 93,173 number they gave for WrestleMania 3 was bullshit, which I started to believe more and more just because at that time, and even to this day in certain cases, WWE will often embellish attendance numbers to suit their needs. The actual attendance for WrestleMania 3 was closer to around 78,000. And this goes back years. I mean, Dave Meltzer is one of the more prominent wrestling sources out there. And he, too, believed the 93,000 number for many years. And as the story goes, Dave had a number of conversations years later with Zane Bresloff, who was Vince's promoter in Michigan for WrestleMania 3 that particular year. And he worked in a similar promotion capacity for WWF for many years, and then eventually for Eric Bischoff in WCW. And then Zane was in a motorcycle accident and died. But Meltzer had conversations with Bresloff, and Bresloff would make comments to him to the effect of, the number was not, in fact, legitimate, that WWF was talking about it so much they actually were starting to believe it themselves. And he had faxed over some information from the Silverdome that actually reflected an attendance of 78,000 and change, and not, in fact, 93,000. Although I believe the gate that WWF would give was, in fact, the legitimate gate, the legitimate money they made off the show, but it was actually 78,000. And the reason they gave the number of 93,173 was they wanted to, and in fact, this is what Gene Okerlund announced that night, was that they had set an all-time indoor attendance record. And in order to be able to announce that, they had to give a number of a certain amount. That was the number they picked. And the funny thing is, I think it was the same year, just a couple of months later, that the Pope came to the Silverdome for Mass and drew a legit 93,600 and something. So he beat the record anyway. although I don't know if you would call that an entertainment event. But yeah, so for the people out there who still believe 93,173 was the legit attendance at WrestleMania 3, I guess we'll never know for sure. I don't have the documents in front of me. But I tend to believe that story more so than what WWE tells me. And if, in fact, that is the case, that would make SummerSlam 1992 at Wembley Stadium in London, England, which apparently that attendance was legit, that would make that event the biggest WWF event in the company's history from an attendance perspective. That event had, I think they announced it at 80,000. It was actually a legit, I think, 79,000. But 79,000 beat 78,000, so SummerSlam 92 still technically holds that record. It is not, in fact, WrestleMania 23, which was another attendance figure that they claimed it was 80,000. It wasn't. Rude Boy writes in, although he's anything but rude in his email here, Dear Solomon, your show is absolute gold for a wrestling fan. Quick question, since the bloggers, as he calls them, are in an uproar about Sting, in WCW, when Sting first debuted his Crow gimmick, how long did he not cut a promo for or even speak at all? I could be wrong in that Sting may have made a comment here and there. I don't really think he did speak at all. Probably for well over a year. I don't think in that year-long build-up to him challenging Hogan at the 1997 Starrcade, I don't think Sting spoke at all. And by the way, that pay-per-view still to this day, well, obviously WCW is dead now, but did the biggest buy rate for any WCW pay-per-view in that company's history. And that was built on a main event where one of the competitors didn't even speak. So that tells you how well that was promoted, although the match itself did not exactly deliver. But I'm pretty sure that even after Sting won the championship, he didn't speak. And I don't think he cut his first full-blown promo until he joined the Wolfpack and was donning the red face paint, which would have been, I guess that would have been in 98 sometime. I don't remember exactly when, but I'm pretty sure it was after he joined Kevin Nash and the members of the Wolfpack, which was a huge mistake, by the way. Sting never, ever should have joined either of the NWL factions. I mean, Sting should have remained a loner. And when he joined the Wolfpack, you know, cool as everybody probably thought it was, and started walking around with a red face paint and pretending like, you know, he was some hip-hop artist, that was when the Sting character started to fail for me. He should have stayed independent of either one of those factions. But I think it was when he joined the Wolfpack, he came out maybe the following week and grabbed the mic. I think he was heading into a pay-per-view match with the Giant. And he, I just remember Tony Schiavone on commentary building it up and saying, "We've been waiting so long to hear this man speak." I'm pretty sure that would have been his first full-blown promo since September of 1996, when we saw Sting with the colored face paint for the final time, and he told people to shove off, and that was when he left, and the next time we saw him was with the Crow gimmick, so probably a good year and a half he went without cutting a real promo. Sean writes in, "Dear Solomonster, on Raw, when CM Punk mentioned the Unforgiven 2008 angle, I immediately thought of you and how you said something along the lines of, if they want to make this storyline good, it means WWE would have to do something they hardly ever do, and that's reference the past. I thought it was eerie that they did just that. While we're on the subject, excuse me, I remember Orton and Punk had a program together around that time. Do you think the feud is better now that Orton is a face and Punk is a heel, or was it better in 08 when Punk was a face and Orton was a heel?" I'm not completely sold just yet on Orton as a face. I've been totally bored by him lately. That being said, I think Punk's best work has been as a heel, so I'm going to go with the way it is now. Orton is a face and Punk is a heel, which is not to say that Punk was terrible as a babyface, or that perhaps he shouldn't be seeking revenge. I mean, if you really think about it, in this particular feud, Punk should be the babyface and Orton should be the heel. I mean, Orton and his thugs beat the shit out of Punk backstage. They jumped the poor guy, put him out of action, forced him to lose his championship, essentially, without ever actually losing it. And now he's seeking revenge. And it's just kind of funny that the roles now are reversed. But I like it better now with Punk as a heel, just because he's so damn good. Luis from Illinois writes in. I call him the Riddler now. He's always got tons of questions. On the new version of Tough Enough, do you think Steve Austin will sound the way he does when he speaks in his promos, or do you think he will take a more subdued tone? You know, I didn't think about this until Luis brought it up, but if Steve Austin is going to go on a show like Tough Enough and basically cut promos almost the way he does on TV, where he talks in these sentence fragments, which is not going to happen. I mean, the reason he does that is because he's in front of a crowd and, you know, he wants them to say what, which of course is just the bane of my fucking existence. I hate that goddamn chant. You know, I've told the story before when my my buddy who does some wrestling for the World of Unpredictable Wrestling here in New York, in Brooklyn, at the world famous Gold's Gym, first show of his that I went to, which might have been the first show he was on, I was actually invited into the ring pre-show. It was a surprise angle, if you will, and I was invited into the ring. It was a little thing that their ring announcer James, you know, who's a friend of mine, invited me into the ring and gave me the microphone, and I had to basically cut a quick promo and get the hell out of there. And I myself received the what chant during that show, which just made me hate that chant even more. But I have a lot of reasons for hating it nonetheless. If you actually did go on Tough Enough and talk like that, I would turn the show off. I can't stand it, and it's a shame because Steve Austin is one of the great promo guys in the wrestling business. And that what chant, I mean, my God. I guess it started as a joke, and I mean, who knew it was going to take off the way it did? But, I mean, that chant in like 03, 04, 05, for years, even now, even today, in 2011, although not as much as it was 5 years ago, that chant killed so many promos for so many different people. It's not even funny. I'm sure Austin will go on the show. Austin has a great sense of humor. He may be cracking jokes and stuff like that, but I think we'll see the serious, normal, like you said, subdued tone of Steve Austin on the show. You know, I don't think it's something that he takes lightly, the fact that these guys are coming onto this show with the hope of becoming a WWE superstar. And it's something that he had to scratch, claw, and fight his way for years. You know, he worked for over 8 years before he even got a shot. Well, that's not entirely true, but 8 years before he won his first WWF championship. He did get a title shot before that. He paid his dues. You know, a lot of the older guys will talk about paying their dues, and they're not fond of the young guys who come and think they're just going to win a game show and just automatically get a shot that they had to work hard for. So I think we'll see that side of Steve Austin on Tough Enough, the tough love side of Steve Austin, if you will. Got a question here from, I think this question comes from Greg. He didn't make it, that's what his email says, but he didn't actually put his name in the email. You got to put your name in the email and how long you've been listening for. After the Hell in a Cell between Undertaker and Big Boss Man at WrestleMania 15, I can't remember why Boss Man was hung by the Brood. Do you know why he was hung, and did he end up leaving TV for a while after that? I don't remember why he got hung. My memory could be a little foggy on this, but I don't think we saw the Boss Man again until June. And again, I could be completely wrong about this. In fact, I probably am wrong. But the only reason I say that is because I think to the King of the Ring in 99, and it was a handicap ladder match. It was Steve Austin against Vince and Shane McMahon for control of the company, which Steve Austin had been made the CEO in an angle several weeks earlier when the greater power was revealed. So basically, Austin was putting his control, his stake in the company on the line in this match. And as Austin was climbing the ladder and trying to grab the briefcase that was hanging above the ring, somebody was controlling the briefcase and raising it higher and higher so he couldn't reach it. And Vince and Shane did end up winning the match, and they took back control of the company. And it was revealed on Raw the next night that it was, in fact, the Big Boss Man who was back in the fold with the corporate ministry, back in their good graces. And I don't know if it was ever explicitly said that he was the one controlling the briefcase, but we were certainly led to believe that when he reunited with the corporate ministry that night. So if that's the case, I would think, I mean, for fuck's sake, if you get hung at a pay-per-view, you probably should never be seen again. But at the very least, you would think that they took him off TV for a few months. So I think that's what happened, but I could be wrong. Chaz had wrote in, he was mentioning some potential sign ideas. I guess he's going to Raw this week, so I don't know if he'll hear this in time, but I think he had mentioned you know, signs maybe for John Cena or Randy Orton, and that's all well and good, but if anybody wants to bring a Solemn Monster sign to Raw, I would highly approve. And anybody out there going to a WWE show in the near future, I mean, we got an SE Scoop sign on the air at the Royal Rumble recently, which was cool. But let's try to get a Solemn Monster sign on the air. I guarantee you, if you get your sign on the air in view of the camera and let me know in advance that you're going to be bringing it so I know who to give credit to, I will mention you on the Sound Off. I might even offer an invitation to have you on the Sound Off. How cool would that be? Prince Gitta writes into the podcast, one of our longtime listeners. He always wondered when the boogeyman would come to the ring every week, the worms that he would pick and eat. Were they real or fake? I just can't imagine anyone chomping on them the way that he did. Was that worse, or were the dirty dollar bills that Ted DiBiase Sr. would stick down his opponent's throats, which was worse? Well, first of all, the worms were real. There are people that would say that they're actually quite nutritious for you. I myself have no intention of ever finding out. But yeah, they were not fake worms. They were very, very real. And God bless the guy, but he would chomp them to bits and swallow their little worm guts every week. And as far as which is worse, this is an easy question to me. Which is worse, eating worms or having dirty dollar bills shoved in your mouth? Easily, the worst thing is having dirty dollar bills shoved in your mouth. And I'll tell you why. First of all, like I said, worms can be rather nutritious for you. So even if you're not into that, and I'm not, there at least you would think is some benefit to it. With money, with currency, with dollar bills, the amount of germs on a single dollar bill and the bacteria on a single dollar bill, because think about it, these dollar bills, you don't know whose hands they've been in. They're being handled by people all over the world, constantly, on a daily basis. And now you're having it put in your mouth. It's like touching a doorknob. I think doorknobs, they've said, are like, it's like the dirtiest surface imaginable, even more so than the top of a toilet seat. Just the thought of somebody sticking a dollar bill in my mouth freaks me out. And maybe that's the germaphobe in me talking, but far worse to have dollar bills shoved down your throat, in my opinion. Sky writes in with a quick note here. He heard a couple of interviews this week, and he thought that I and perhaps the rest of you would be interested in knowing. Jake the Snake appeared on Live Audio Wrestling. Of course, Jake wrestled what he claims was his retirement match recently at the Wrestle Reunion event in L.A. We'll see if that sticks or not. JR appeared on Pro Wrestling Insider show, and Paul Bearer was on Right After Wrestling. I've heard a couple of different Paul Bearer interviews recently. Really good guy. And he's taking independent bookings again, is Paul Bearer. So check those interviews out if you have not already done so. Chris Jericho is starting to make the rounds as well, and I want to use this as a cheap plug here for SE Scoops. Webmaster Mike is conducting a phone interview this week with the one and only Chris Jericho, who, of course, his new book, Undisputed, which is a sequel to the Lion's Tale, is going to be, it's probably already available in certain places, but it officially goes on sale this week, I believe on Wednesday, at fine book retailers across the country, or Amazon.com. So, in any event, Mike is going to be conducting that interview with Jericho this week. So, if you have any questions, perhaps, that you would like for him to ask the former Y2J, you can probably send that to sescoops@gmail.com. Do not send them to me, because they will go unnoticed. So, just wanted to make mention of that. Tony writes in, have you ever purchased and tried Jim Ross's barbecue sauce? I want to know if it's a slobber knocker, as he says, before I buy it. I have not tried the barbecue sauce. I've actually tried his beef jerky. I just wanted to place an order for it once and just see what this thing looked like. And sure enough, it had Jim Ross's likeness on the package. The beef jerky was fine. I'm not like a big beef jerky fan. I've tried it a couple of times before, so I figured, what the hell? And it was actually pretty good. It was actually pretty good. I would imagine the barbecue sauce is probably even better. I think everybody should try JR's barbecue sauce at least once and make up their own mind if they like it or not. And lastly here, Jamie from Niagara Falls. As always, great work on the podcast, Solo Monster. It's one of the few things I find interesting in today's wrestling. Well, thank you. I want to hear your thoughts on a scenario concerning Jerry Lawler. One of the casualties of WWE's youth movement was Jim Ross. Assuming the King gets his WrestleMania match, do you think Lawler could be phased out of the announce booth as well post-WrestleMania? It only makes sense because Jim Ross was taken off the booth while the King remains, despite being 2 years older than Jim Ross. Well, I agree on that last point. It's kind of hypocritical for them to phase out Jim Ross by thinking he looks too old, or he is too old, because Lawler is, in fact, 61, and Jim Ross is not even 60 yet. But, no, I don't see Lawler being phased out at all. I think they like having Jerry Lawler in that role. They can use him, as they are now, as a performer in the ring every now and then. He even at 61 years of age, the King is awesome. The King can move around the ring almost as good as some of the younger guys. He throws the best punch in wrestling. And whether he's cutting a promo or whatever they're using him for, like they're doing with The Miz right now, he can be used very, very effectively. He's very effective in that role when they let him cut his own promos and do his own thing and getting an angle over. Lawler is old school, and there are very few people left in the wrestling business as good as he is at getting over an angle and making it seem more realistic. He's far more valuable to them, I think, in that role than even as an announcer. But they'll never use him as a full-time worker, nor should they. And I think him being in the announce booth, even though the King is not quite what he used to be, and I don't blame him entirely for that. I think a lot of it is just the evolution of what Vince McMahon expects out of his announcers. But I don't see them getting rid of the King, and I do hope he gets his WrestleMania match. And I would love to see the King against either Michael Cole or a surrogate, perhaps, with Michael Cole in their corner. And with the stipulation that if the King wins, Jim Ross comes back and replaces Michael Cole in the announce booth. I know it's not going to happen, but to me, that would be, that stipulation alone would get me to spend my money on WrestleMania. So we're going to cinch up the mailbag. That's going to do it for this week's edition of The Sound Off, episode 146. You can email me your questions, as always, at thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter. We're almost at 700 followers now. Twitter.com/solomonster. and friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolemonster. That's where we always have fun on the Facebook page, but you got to be friends there. So friend me on there. For the record, I am loving my new iPhone 4. I know I talked about that a lot, and sometimes things get built up so much, and then they kind of come, and it's disappointing, or you know, you go through this honeymoon phase, which I guess I'm still in right now, and it's really just a phone at the end of the day, but it does so much more. It's just an amazing device compared to the BlackBerry that I've been using for the last 2.5 years, and one of the coolest things I think that I didn't even realize that I would be able to do is I downloaded a Kindle app. Now, I admit I don't do a lot of reading of, like, general novels and stuff like that, but you know, I read the wrestling books. I think I've read not most of them, but I've read a lot of the good ones. But the one that I never actually finished, I started reading it and I never finished it, I never really even got that far into it, was the Chris Jericho book. And it had been so long since I had gone back to reread what I did read and to pick up where I left off. And you know, a friend of mine has the book in hardcover, but I don't want to carry around the hardcover book with me all the time. So I went into the Kindle store on Amazon, and sure shit, they had Chris Jericho's first book in I guess as an ebook for like $7, and they said that they would send it wirelessly to my phone. So I said, "What the fuck?" So I ordered the book, and sure enough, I've got Chris Jericho's first book on my phone. I want to read his second book, and so I want to make sure I get the first one done before I get to the second one. So I am now in the process of rereading and reading Chris Jericho's first book on my phone. And I think that's kind of cool. Plus, I'm just addicted to Angry Birds. So I've officially become addicted to the Angry Birds fever. People warned me about it. I know a lot of you warned me. And I did not heed your warnings. And I am now hooked. So, and that is, in fact, not why the podcast went up late this weekend. It went up late for different reasons, but there you go. So for the people who have asked about the iPhone, thumbs up. So far, so good. We'll be back here next week, episode 147. So until then, be well, stay safe. Thanks for listening.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemn Monster sounds off on SCScoops.com.